This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Wednesday, December 18th, back from a little stint in Omaha, Nebraska, doing a class that we gave several years ago here as part of a Beit Midrash. It was an attempt of, instead of doing a regular shiur, have, you know, try people do more chavrusa time. I think it worked okay that week, but it didn't seem like it was sustainable. We had initially planned this for Hanukkah, and the topic then was gambling in Jewish law. And by request, we're bringing it back, and this was also before we started recording. So, the topic today is gambling in Jewish law, and I included here, you know, I decided not to take out the rhetorical questions, even though I updated some of the sources. You could understand, like, why it's somewhat appropriate for Hanukkah, because of the whole story with the dreidel, it's what people used to do. So, what really is the deal with gambling? And we're going to see tonight that it's a lot more complicated than you think. It's going to be hard to get a straight answer, in particular from Rambam. Normally we do straight Gemaras and we can get most of the information we need from there. Rambam here is going to be important because, as we're going to see, Rambam is all over the place. So let's start us off with, what do we mean by gambling? Right? Now, as we keep saying, when you have something new, or at least something modern, something contemporary, you look towards the Talmud to see, well, what precedent do we have in Jewish law? Are there any laws, are there any actions mentioned already in the Talmud or in the core of legal, I don't want to say codes because the Talmud isn't really a code, but precedent in Jewish law that we can say this is most like that and say, does this work? And then we have to say, if so, how? And that's how halacha, you know, starts getting applied. So Josh, start us off. Mishnah Sanhedrin 3:3.
And these are ineligible to be witnesses or judges: a gambler with dice, a usurer, a pigeon trainer, and traders in the produce of the sabbatical year. Rabbi Shimon said, at first they called them gatherers of the produce of the sabbatical year, but when the oppressors grew in number, they changed their name to traders in the sabbatical produce. Rabbi Yehuda said, when is this so? If they have no other occupation but this, but if they have other means of livelihood, they are eligible.
All right. Yeah. So the main thing so far here is the gambler with dice, Mesachik Bekuvia. This is the Sinsiner's translation. Mesachik literally means plays with dice. Today, someone gambles with dice. They're referring to?
Craps.
There you go. Referring to craps. You ever play craps? Not going to summarize the laws, but whatever. That's usually your dice game. Did they have craps back then? Probably not, but they had, you know, let's say something similar. So, if you do that, you are considered pasula edut. Your testimony is invalid in court. Doesn't count for anything. Rabbi Yehuda says, well, this only applies if it's bisman she'in lehen umanut. If they have no skill, they have no trade, there is no other winning, elahu. The only way that they make their money, their skill, the only thing of usefulness they do are these sorts of things. Like pigeon racing. Anyone's a fan of Clifford Geertz. You also have cockfight. Well, I don't know if cockfighting counts as the same, but you might be able to throw it in there too. Anyone here read Clifford Geertz? Read Clifford Geertz. The culture. Anyway. Okay. So we have a Mishnah that says someone who, let's hold for right now, according to Rav Yehuda, someone who makes his living shooting dice, pasula edut. All right? Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm going to have a few people. Josh, do the Gemara, and we'll get around. So, Gemara is Sanhedrin 24b.
What wrong does the dice player do? Rami ben Barchama said, he is disqualified because gambling, is an asmata.
Well, explain what that is.
An asmata is not legally binding. Rabbi Sheshet said, such cases do not come under the category of asmata, but the reason is that they, dice players, are not concerned with the general welfare. Wherein do they differ? If he, the gambler, acquired another trade.
So let's explain what this is. Asmachta is somewhat complicated. I included here Cencino's notes. To try to summarize this, what an asmachta is, it is when you enter into certain agreements with a condition to happen in the future, such that is dependent on what's going to happen. The reason why this is a weird category of an asmachta is when you put in such a clause, you don't expect that clause to happen, or at least one of the two parties doesn't expect the clause to happen. Since they don't expect a clause to happen, then the means of acquisition has a deficiency. Normally, when we have rules of acquisition in Jewish law, not to be confused with Ferengi, neither of you know what a Ferengi is. All right. No. You're all better off like that. Anyway, according to the Jewish laws of acquisition, we try to have something called Gemar Da'at. Fairness of trade is that everyone knows what they're getting. I know the price, you know the object. Here, you're dealing with a weird situation with a clause that's put in such a way that should, like I fail to pay back a loan, something else is going to kick in. Now, the assumption is, I know that I fully intend on paying back the loan on time. So would that other clause kick in? That's the question of an asmachta, because since at the time I made that condition, I never expected it to hit, then it's as if I wasn't fully into the sale. There happens to be a dispute in the Mishnah whether or not an asmachta counts or not. General halacha is asmachta lo kana, that's how halacha concludes, but at least it's a machloket tanaim, right? So it's not so pashut, because you could easily argue, well, maybe he did. And you think about today, in terms of commerce, and this is something to keep in the back of your mind as we discuss this, having transactions based on certain conditions, does that really mean that you never really intended it? We know what a balloon payment is, right? Well, actually, balloon payment's different. Let's say you hit with late fees on your credit card. Why do you agree to pay, you know, late fees when you pay your credit card? Presumably, because you don't expect to pay them. Right? So one end you can say, well, that's an asmachta, right? Then you haven't really concluded that, you know, this transaction is dependent on something else in the future. On the other hand, maybe that's what's behind all contracts, right? When people enter into an arrangement, there's some probability of it happening. Were there no probability at all, no one would bother throwing it in, right? That would be yefshal l'kayemo. It wouldn't happen, so it's just meaningless. So keep that in mind, that if an asmachta is really not kona, you want to take that to an extreme, the way, you know, that's going to be very problematic for many business transactions, particularly in the financial industry. All right? So that was opinion one of why it's wrong. All right? The second opinion, which is Rav Sheshet, is they are ein osikin b'yushuvo shel olam. They are not engaged really with the dwelling of the world. The way it's described here is general welfare. Say, these things, dice players are not productive. Right? Now, seems that those are reasons why you're pasulin. Any thoughts as to why not engaging in yeshuvo shel olam means you are invalid from being a witness? Want to take a guess at that? Meaning, if you want to say, sir, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I would think that, you know, if you don't, you witness something for, like, the good of somebody else, I guess. I mean, if you're witnessing something, it's not for your own benefit,
right?
I would say. So if you're not involved with general well-being of someone, then...
Yeah. I mean, when you're not osek b'yushuvo shel olam, you're sort of removed from society in a way. And if you're removed from society, it's going to be difficult. I mean, that's a bit of conjecture of what we can argue behind it, but at least those are the two problems that the Gemara and Sanhedrin has regarding Masachik Pekuvia, someone who plays dice. Question. The practical halachic difference would be, let's say he gathered another trade, right? That would be also the Rabbi Yehuda thing. Like, let's say he could do something else. So according to Rav Sheshet, that would be fine, because he's still osek in yeshuvo shel olam. According to Rami Bar Chama, it's not. Why? Because there's a flaw in the transaction of gambling, right? Because you're acquiring things not through the proper measure, not through the proper methods of Jewish acquisition. Okay? So that's straight up. Risa takes source number two here. This is Gemara Sanhedrin 25b. Other things somewhat related to gambling on further dimensions. That first one is the, go ahead.
Dice players include the following. Those who play with checkers, and not only with checkers, but even with nutshells and pomegranate peels.
Meaning, dice lav dafka. What they mean is not only dice. When the Gemara gives examples, or is specific about something, two ways to understand that usually. You can either say, only the specific things that the Talmud prohibited is what is prohibited, or maybe they're typologies, maybe they're categories, and things similar. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin continues in 25b saying, you know, it's not just dice players, like you substitute something else for dice, right? There are lots of ways to gamble. So it's not purely the means of dice playing. And, oh, dice is bad, but like cards, those are fine. A roulette wheel, sure, right? Neither one of those are dice, right? So keep that in mind. It's not just specific dice. And here, at least, we have an explicit Gemara that says, lav dafka. Well, doesn't use those words, but you know, says lav dafka. It's not only dice, it's things of the like. Okay? Do the Mishnah Rosh Hashanah too.
The following are ineligible to testify for the new moon. Gamblers, usurers, pigeon flyers, those who traffic in produce of the sabbatical year, and slaves. It is a general rule that for any testimony for which a woman is disqualified, these also are disqualified.
Yeah. So you see, gamblers are like women. not the most... Well, we're dealing with egalitarianism next week about that.
Okay.
Put themselves in a certain category that we do not trust them, you know, anyway.
Does that mean they can't count for a minion?
No, because that's not edut. It's zekla kol edut she'ena isha kishera.
I see.
Anything that, if you wouldn't trust, and that doesn't mean that, women, when it comes to testimony, it also gets, there's certain things for which women may be believed as they have ne'emanut, as they are trustworthy for certain things. Consider it like discovery of some sort, meaning they might not be able to give a formal testimony, but there are times when something that they have seen or something observed might be acceptable as, you know, sort of a fact thing, as opposed to, you know, we are testifying that so-and-so did something way, way, way beyond the scope of this class.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Mishnah and Shabbat 23:2. Translation is a little weird here. A man may count his guests and his dainty portions by word of mouth, but not from writing. A man may cast lots with his sons and the members of his household for the table, provided that he does not intend to offset a large portion against a small one. And priests may cast lots for sacrifices on festivals, but not for the portions. If anyone's interested, we've been doing a bunch of the priests casting lots during Daf Yomi, part of the Yom Kippur service, all his Azazel thing. Anyway, the Gemara explains a little bit. What do you mean by casting lots for your sons at the household table? Gemara in Shabbat 149b, even setting a large portion against a small portion. What is the reason? As Rav Yehuda's dictum in Rav's name, yet only for his sons and household, but not for strangers. What is the reason? As Rav Yehuda's dictum in Samuel's name, further setting a large portion against a small portion is forbidden even on weekdays in the case of strangers. What is the reason? On account of gambling. So here you have an example of, like, if you want to try to, you know, if you want to cast lots for, you know, things at the table, like, right, you know, where does everyone sit? Fine, you know, set up a bingo ball. But once you have it set up as, if you, you know, you sit at this table, you get more food. Well, that's already, language here is, af b'chol, even during the weekday, la'achayrim asur, for others it is prohibited, mai ta'ama, what is the reason? Mishum kuvya. Now here's the big question. Is Mesachik Bekuvia Asur? Is it prohibited? And if so, how? What do you think?
So, meaning like is what prohibited exactly? Like the drawing of the lots, or like gambling in general, or?
See, that's what's tricky, uh-huh. Now, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The Mishnah and Sanhedrin doesn't say that it is prohibited. Again, the rules with prohibitions, you have to demonstrate that something is either biblically or rabbinically prohibited. Mm-hmm. So is playing dice prohibited according to Jewish law? According to the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, doesn't really seem to be that way. Meaning it's not a good thing to do, mind you. But also given the reasons why, according to Rav Rami Bar Chama, maybe, right? Because of, weird ways of acquiring money. But according to Rav Sheshet, doesn't seem to be a problem. He doesn't say it's forbidden. It just says you're not engaged in the world. Mm-hmm. According to the Gemara in Shabbat, though, it seems weird. It says, Asur Mishum Kuvia. It is forbidden to cast lots to determine who gets more food because of, like, shooting dice or kind of like gambling. So it's a little bit strange here. Mm-hmm. Meaning you don't, on one hand, the Gemara in Shabbat seems to assume it's prohibited, whereas the Mishnah and the Gemara in Sanhedrin doesn't really seem to say that there's an intrinsic prohibition. Okay? And the difference would be, like, even though, you might gamble and you might be pasula edut, did you break Jewish law? Okay? Something to keep in your back of your mind. And we'll describe, when we finish Rambam, we'll see about how other things might apply. So, start us off, Joshua. Okay. Rule Rambam, Laws of Witnesses 10:4.
Similarly, one who plays with dice, and this is when he has no other profession except for this, since he is not occupied in the settling of the world, he is under the assumption as being sustained through dice, which is like stealing. And this does not refer to dice specifically, but even playing with nutshells or pomegranate peels.
So, what do you think this is like? He actually throws in a few interesting things here.
I mean, he seems to say that you can't do it. That isn't sore.
Right. So, well, it's... Well, right now here it's a little bit weird, just on this one alone. In terms of what does he follow, he says, one, he seems to follow like Rav Sheshet, that the problem of gambling, of why does it make you disqualified from serving as a witness, is because, Eino osek b'yushuvo shel olam. Mm-hmm. Those were the words that we saw in Rav Sheshet. You're not engaged in the world. And he also says, right, Nechezka, it's a vak gezel. It's the dust of stealing, meaning it's kind of like it, which you could argue is kind of like Rami Bar Chama. So it seems to be he kind of combines the two of them somehow. Or he said, take, this is Rambam, Laws of Theft and Lost Objects, 6-7, Gzelev Aveda.
The sages forbade many things due to theft, and one who violates them violates theft according to rabbinic law. For example, someone who races birds and plays with dice.
All right, so here, Rambam seems very explicit that the problem with gambling, he doesn't even say here that it's avak gezel, that it's like stealing. Remember, that's what he said in Hilchot Eidut. Here he's saying, asru chachami mishum gezel. Very explicit here, rabbinic decree against stealing. Which is different than what he said in Hilchot Eidut. Arisa, keep up with this. Rambam, Laws of Theft and Loss, Gzelev Aveda 6:10.
What does it mean that someone is a dice player? These are people who play with twigs or pebbles or bones and the like. And they make a condition between them that whoever beats the other in this game will take such and such. And this is theft according to rabbinic law. Even though he takes the money willingly, since he takes the money of his friend for nothing as a game and joke, this is theft.
So this is a weird definition of thievery. Right? Even if you want to say it's a smachta lokana, and that's a bit of an extreme here, meaning an smachta lokana is, again, smachtas are kind of complicated to understand, but it means that the acquisition is not a valid acquisition to say, oh, well, maybe it's kind of like stealing. Here, Rambam's definition of stealing in the Hebrew of Hilchot Gzelev Aveda is that lakach mamon chaveiro bechinam, you're taking the money for free, not doing anything, derech sechuk, it's like just a matter of joke, if I raise a gezel, and this is theft.
I don't really understand how that's theft. I'm having a hard time.
Oh, hold on 1 second. We're going to have an even bigger question on Rambam.
Okay.
On this year. This is next halacha. Rambam in Theft and Law 6:11 says, The person who plays dice with a non-Jew does not incur the prohibition of theft, but there is a prohibition of busying oneself with pointless activities, for it is inappropriate for a person to occupy all his days except for wisdom and settling the world. Ravad, if he does not have another profession except for dice playing, he still is an invalid witness if he plays with non-Jews, and certainly if he learns from a non-Jew's actions. Here's where it gets tricky. Rambam in Laws of Theft and Laws Kzeila Vaveda 1-2 says quite explicitly, to steal any amount is a violation of biblical law. Even from an idol-worshipping Gentile, it is forbidden to steal or cheat him. And if one had stolen or cheated him, he must return what was acquired illicitly. See, when I said Rambam was all over the place, I really meant that. Right? So let's throw together a whole... This is important for anyone who's like a diehard Rambam fan. Says, oh, Rambam's like straight consistent. I'm sure that there's some Lumdish Rosh Hashiva who can like make all of these things the same. But you're going to have to do some really creative reads and wreak some violence to one halacha or another in Rambam. Summarize. We have, and again, one place, Rambam calls it avak gezel. Not explicit stealing, but it's kind of like stealing. Mm-hmm. Two, he says that it is a rabbinic prohibition. Three, the reason why he says why it's a rabbinic prohibition is, or at least why it's theft, is because even when two parties agree to it, you're taking money for free like a game, and somehow that's bad, though he never mentions that word asmachta in that particular halacha. He does, however, say that if you gamble with a non-Jew, that's not really considered theft, but it still is forbidden to steal from a non-Jew. I mean, the problem with gambling with a non-Jew isn't a matter of the transaction, it's that you're not doing anything productive. But the same action, meaning, or I should say the same transaction, of acquiring money based on certain conditions set up by rules of gambling, oh, that's okay if you do it with a non-Jew, just not with a Jew. Now, perhaps he can say that the gezerah, that this decree, was only leveled to a Jew playing with a non-Jew. Mm-hmm. Unless, but I mean, that seems kind of weird, though. You're saying, if I do it with a Jew, well, that's a matter of theft. But the same action with a non-Jew is considered okay. That's no longer theft. Mm-hmm. Even though Rambam says quite explicitly, you're not allowed to steal from a non-Jew, something which some rabbis today take issue with and actually would say, you are allowed to steal from a non-Jew, but that aside, right? Rambam is all over the place here. So, according to Rambam, is it forbidden to gamble? The answer is yes. Is he consistent?
No.
And he gives us too many different reasons to even begin to try to extrapolate what the problem is. Be it theft, he doesn't mention asmachta, don't really have a source for where the Gemara says explicitly it is forbidden, it is asur to gamble. And the fact that you can do it with a non-Jew seems to mean that there's something else unique to it, even though he doesn't feel that you are osek, that you are, it's an isur of osek b'dvarim b'teilim. You aren't engaging in pointless activities. All right. Now, here are a couple of other related laws that will make things even more complicated. Just because you thought it was too easy. Josh, okay. This is Laws of Mechira, Laws of Selling, 21.3.
One who says to his friend, whatever is in this house, I sell to you for such and such, and whatever is in this box, I sell to you for such and such, or in this bag, etc., and the taker accepted the deal and took the item, this is not a valid acquisition, for he did not have full knowledge. For the taker did not know what was in the container, be it straw or gold. And this is like playing with dice or anything of the sort.
So he approaches the logic. This seems to be more like the asmachta category here, mm-hmm. where when you enter in... okay, you guys should remember Let's Make a Deal, right? Yes, you got one of my references.
That's the first thing that came to mind with this.
Thank you! Okay! Right, so Let's Make a Deal. Right, you remember how it goes? Like, you have a certain price up there. It's like, well, do you go for, you know, door number one, door number two, take the money. Incidentally, do you all know what the answer to that question is? There is an answer. This is a digression, but it's a really fun one. It's called the Monty Hall Paradox. Any of y'all hear about the Monty Hall Paradox? This is awesome. If anyone's interested, they did a thing on this in Mythbusters. Okay. Here's how it works. When you got three options, right, you pick one, you see, well, here's what you got. You can either go, you know, for door number one or door number two or stay put. So you have those three options. So people do different things here. So, like, you got three doors. Actually, no. Sorry, we have to redo that a second. You get to choose one out of three options. You pick one. They open it up. Right? Usually it'd be nothing or something. And they'll say, well, prize mine door number one, two, or three. Say, I pick door number two. It's like, open up door number, you know, then they'll open up usually one or two, whatever. Say, well, do you want to stick with door number two or do you want to go with door number three?
You're supposed to stick with it, right?
Wrong.
You're supposed to switch?
You are always, always, always supposed to switch. And you think, well, why is that? People say, well, it's 50-50 odds. Mm-hmm. It's either going to be in door number two or door number three. That's not true. That's looking at it atomically. Here's how it goes. When you've got the three options, you've picked one. They already know which one you've picked, all right? They're going to open the door for drama, one of the empty ones. Mm-hmm. Now, the odds when you first picked one, that you had, the odds of you, whatchamacallit, when you first picked, you had a 1 in 3 chance, right? So you've got a 1 in 3 chance that what you have is the right, and the odds that you were wrong were a 2 in 3 chance. Mm-hmm. Once they open up that empty door, then the odds are higher in the favor that it's in the other one. So you have 1 in 3 on one side. Now it comes 2 to 3 on the other side that one of those two doors had it. So if that first one didn't, the odds are that the other one did. And they actually did this on Mythbusters and they explained the whole thing. See the video of them doing the Monty Hall paradox. Mm-hmm. And you can actually see why mathematically over time this will play out. So if you, even though it seems weird, because it seems like it's a 50-50 chance whether or not you do or you don't, the math does work out that it's really a 1 in 3 chance that you were right, but a 2 in 3 chance that it's in the other side, and you already know that it's 1 out of 2. So, yeah.
Seems strange, but all right.
That's why it's called the paradox. It's Monty Hall paradox. I mean, there's a, I think, probably more technical term, but it's named after Monty Hall. Anyway, point is, let's make a deal. You decide to go for the mystery box. Mm-hmm. So Rambam says, that doesn't work halakhically. That violates the rules of acquisition. Why? Because you don't know what you're getting. Even in Storage Wars, they let you, you know, take a look and see something that's there. It's like, well, I see kind of, they don't give you too much, but other Storage Wars might even, you know, kick it, might even apply here too. So Rambam says this doesn't work because it's like Gezel. It says here, well, not Gezel, he says here, it's like Mesachik Bekuvia. It's like you're playing dice because at that mode of acquisition, you're giving up money for something, but you don't know exactly what it is. And that's a problem in the transaction. Seems here, Rambam is focusing less on the Yeshuvoshel Olam part. Doesn't seem to call it Gezel, but he seems to equate Kuvia with an Asmachta. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even though that the Gemara gave us a nafgamina between Rami Bar Chama and, it was Rami Bar Chama, Rami Bar Chama and Rav Sheshet, right, where they say Ika Beinayu, there is a distinction between them, Rambam seems to use both interchangeably, right, because there's nothing wrong with Yeshuvo Shalom, you're still engaging in commerce. Here's another one. It's a take number, Rambam Hilcho, also Mechira, 11.2.
When is the above said? When he acquires through one of the normal means of acquisition and he has the requirement to fulfill the condition. But if he did not acquire it immediately and the condition was placed, that if the condition was fulfilled, that the acquisition, he would acquire the item, and if not, then he wouldn't. Then this is not a proper means of acquisition, for this is an
Asmachta.
For his reward.
It should be he relies.
Yeah.
Sorry.
For he relies on acquisition to do such and such, and any Asmachta does not take hold, for he did not resolve in his heart to transfer ownership.
Right, so that's, again, what we summarized at the very beginning. Now here is where it gets really fun. Rambam Moshe Shabbat 23:17 says, Asur lahapis v'lischok b'kuvya b'shabbat. You're not allowed to hold a lottery or to play dice on Shabbat. Mipnei shehu kemekach u'memkar. Because it's like you're engaging in regular business. Now, unless your regular business is like stealing, you know, or to put another way, the analogy I give is about why this is particularly wacky. It's like saying, I'm not allowed to stab someone on Shabbat because I'm going to draw blood. As opposed to, I'm not allowed to stab someone on Shabbat because I'm not allowed to stab people. Right? If it's really a problem of gezela, and as such that Rambam says, it is a rabbinic prohibition to be mesachek bekuvya, right, to play with dice, then why? Why? Would Rambam have to go and add, oh, by the way, don't do it on Shabbat? I don't believe Rambam also says you're not allowed to steal on Shabbat. Only he says you're not allowed to, yes, he doesn't say you're not allowed to murder, well, whatever. Doesn't say you're not allowed why would he say don't have to, you're not allowed to steal? And if it's a rabbinic decree, right, then, yeah, you see the problem.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Now, we went through at least the Gemara, we went through Rambam, and we're left with massive, massive question marks. Such of the specific question, is it prohibited? And if so, why? With that, let's try looking at a few scenarios of gambling. Anyone here ever gamble at all or do anything like it?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So when I was in Chicago, I actually took part in one poker game, lest you know, accuse me of gambling. Here's what the situation was. And I learned a lot about gambling that year. I was with a few brilliant people, some like uber math geeks that, you know, at least ones on Wall Street, others were lawyers, but they would like calculate pot odds. I mean, you saw the movie Rounders, right?
Yeah, sure.
Right, so the movie Rounders, like, people are really into that movie. You should see this movie Rounders for no other reason, the Russian accent done by John Malkovich. It is the most over-the-top, not quite, you know, racist stereotypical, but getting there. It's really impressive that he could carry on the whole thing, and the fact that he could do it with a straight face and no one else cracked up on film, or at least they were able to get... Anyway... Point is, I was introduced to one sort of distinction. Difference between a buy-in tournament and a cash game. Mm-hmm. So here would be a distinction that might actually apply. A cash game is, we pull out our wallets, and we put down money for the specific hands, right? And the tournament is, you have a buy-in. In this case, it was $10. Top certain amount of people get a cut of all the money. Now, when I did it, I had absolutely no expectation of getting any money back. It was for entertainment purposes only. For $10, I lasted about 2.5 hours, knocked out some impressive people, which I thought was kind of cool. At the end, as things go on, they actually raise the blinds, like the ante that you put in, such that, you know, you don't really play that many hands, or at least in no limit hold'em poker, whatever.
So it ends eventually.
Well, it has to end eventually. Otherwise, right. You just like keep checking until you have that, and that's ridiculous. Uh-huh. Like, you're going to have to do something, so you get blinded out. I got knocked out. Basically, I got knocked out with a pair of twos, like pocket twos, which was the best hand that I had seen in a long time. Point is, $10, I got 2.5 hours of entertainment. Better than seeing most movies today. All right?
Yeah.
Cash game, you could say it's pretty different. The World Series of Poker is a tournament. I forget what the entry is. I know at one point it's on like
$10,000.
I thought it was higher.
I think it's 10, but all right. I could be wrong.
Let's say $10,000 to get in. Sometimes people have sponsors that put up the money, and if they win, the sponsors get a cut of the winnings, which is over $8 million at this point. Well, it depends on which tournament. There are lots of tournaments at the World Series of Poker.
It's a lot.
No Limit Hold'em is the, you know, big one that everyone likes. So you can say, well, is there a difference between that too? Because what you're gambling with are effectively points. Meaning, when I got put in my $10, let's say I got $500 worth of chips. It's like starting off with 500 points, not actually gambling with real money, as opposed to a cash game. Money is on the table and we're just pulling stuff out. So that's one distinction to consider in terms of, would either one be, like you might say with Rambam, like you're not really doing much except maybe blowing off steam. Like it's not something you should do for extended periods of time, according to Rambam. But let's hold off on what does it mean to be Osek B'Yishuvo Shel Olam. We'll table that question. We will get. Actually, you know what? Let's discuss that now. Yishuvo Shel Olam. How is gambling not part of Yishuvo Shel Olam? Well, what is the real flaw? You are engaging in a whole bunch of microtransactions with a couple of individuals with the intent of making money. If that's the issue, you can apply that to a whole lot of other things. I know some people have tried applying that to the stock market. which is, you should know, very different from regular gambling, because you are, like, let's say you're buying stock. You are purchasing equity in a company because you think the company is going to do well. Other people think the company is going to do poorly. Mm-hmm. Your intent isn't, or let's assume you're honest here. You're not doing a pump and dump scheme. You believe that this is a trend that's going to happen, and you think the value is going to go up. But at that moment of transaction, you're doing something that is, you know, really appropriate. And it's not pure gambling, because there's always some, what's a good way of putting this? You could argue, well, let me rephrase that. There are some financial instruments that are pretty much gambling, because you're putting in a certain amount of money now because there's either you expect things to go certain ways and maybe it will and maybe it won't. But effectively, like when you buy someone else's debt, like at a certain risk, you're taking on a certain risk with a certain measure of reward that you think it could happen, it might not, or any other complicated reason. Capital is really complicated. I wouldn't call that a straight gambling, because even when you're engaging in commerce, financial liquidity is important in markets, such that someone else might have a lot of stocks and bonds, but money, M1, I think that's what it is, M1, is more liquid than stocks and bonds. Like it's, anyway. Important distinction there about what is Osek Bishavosh Olam. If you're just a stockbroker, well, it's a little more complicated because you're actually helping out companies, mm-hmm. or you're helping out other individuals raise capital in order to do other things. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, you might be able to compare it more to something like collecting interest, where just the pure value of holding capital alone is, you know, prohibited. Like you can't just use, oh, like I will, like just simply borrowing and lending money. All right, well, now I'm profiting, not because I've actually contributed anything, but simply because I own capital. So you might be able to say it's a little bit closer to that side than your basic stocks and bonds. For other things like, you know, futures or options, that's when it gets even more complicated. You know, if you're saying certain types of, you know, option, you know, I'll buy a certain amount at a certain time, well, then you're sort of betting, like, one person wants to stay, both people want stable prices, one assumes it's going to go up, the other assumes that it's not. That's a little bit different. That's, you know, almost hedging in a certain way. You get into complicated, you know, puts and calls and stuff like that. You might have issues there of an asmachta, certainly, but whatever. Those might be closer to gambling. Where were we? Right, so there's that. Let me ask you this. What about a raffle?
I was thinking, I was on it last night.
Right. Typical, I mean, compare a raffle and or the lottery. Mega Millions was just $650 million. Two winning tickets are sold, one in California, one in Atlanta. Is that considered gambling or not? You put down, let's say, a dollar, you get a number. Do you assume that you're going to win? Probably not. But is that really gambling? Or what about, whatchamacallit? Would you say that was, so in terms of an asmachta, would that really count here? Because you're saying, well, I'm giving you this because in the event that this happens, then I'm going to get a whole lot of money. But to what extent do you really expect that condition to happen? On one hand, you say, well, no one realistically thinks they're going to win. Mm-hmm. But if you're so certain that you're going to lose, why do you actually give them money?
Right.
Right? Seems a little weird. Raffles kind of the same way, but on a much smaller scale. Except there you can say, well, it's going for a good cause.
Right.
But does that matter? If it's really a problem of gezel, you know, exactly. Charities aren't allowed to steal.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, look, for everything, all these issues, by the way, you're going to find multiple opinions here. So one way of looking at it is that, yeah, this isn't a smachta, this is like gambling, and this could be problematic. Another way of looking at it could be, when you view certain things like gambling or raffles, it might very well be that you don't intend on winning. Rabbi Moshe Tendler once explained it in class that when people go to Vegas and the like, no one really expects to win. What do? You're basically paying money to have that thrill of experience, such that in the event that you win, you get this shot of endorphins. So ki'ilu, you know, on the flip side, more people would win in Vegas, at least one hand or two, than win the lottery.
Yeah.
But at least, if you put that $1 in the lottery, you've got a day or so of escapism where you could dream, what can happen if I win?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you're not really paying money for money, or at least giving money for money. You're paying money because it allows you, I mean, it's cheaper escapism, probably slightly healthier than drugs, unless you've got an addiction problem with that. Gambling, too. You know, you start because, like, that thrill of winning is just so fantastic. At least that was his take. Other people clearly do it professionally. Many people in the world's use of poker do it online, and some people can make a pretty decent living out of getting stuff online. Especially when you've got, like, three windows open, right? You're playing, like, multiple games at a shot, and there are people who know the system's real. Anyway, so there's that. But if that's the case, maybe that could also apply to gambling, too. I'll explain how. And this might also depend on how good of a player you are. Have you ever watched the World Series of Poker? Okay, so you have. When you see the World Series of Poker, let's say No Limit Hold'em. Now, the way No Limit Hold'em works is everyone gets two cards. You've got the blinds go in. Those are the antes. And then if you don't like your hands, many people just fold. They don't like the cards. And you play it anyway, thinking something like some hands are playable, some hands are not. Like if you've got, I don't know, a 4-7 that don't match, right? You're probably going to fold that because that's a really bad hand, all right? So many people go out in that first round, fine. But the antes are there because if you don't have the antes, no one's betting anything. Then you have what's called the flop, which is dealer puts out three cards. Then people go around. So now you've got your typical five-card set of, you know, poker. Same poker rules. You don't know the rules of poker, not going to summarize them now. Another round of betting where people can either check, pass, someone can raise, and then everyone else can call and raise. Tragic. Then you got the turn, fourth card, and the river, the fifth card. And the winner is whoever has the best five-card poker hand. Assuming five-card, you know, no, they're also, whatever. There are a whole bunch of variations. Regular Texas Hold'em poker, simple, okay? When you watch the World Series of Poker, there's a camera by each one of the players. And they look up, you know, they raise the cards very quickly, because the less that you play with them, the less that you're going to reveal what you have, so you look it up. And on the screen, it gives you percentages. It says, well, based on, let's say, the flop, the first three cards, this guy has, you know, a 46% winning the hand. That person has a 20% chance of winning the hand. When bettors, professionals, put in money, they know how to make that calculation. And they do something, like one of the things they calculate is pot odds, meaning here's how much is in the pot, here's how much money I need to put in order to get the rest of that pot, and compare that to how strong of a hand they have, and trying to guess what could the other person possibly have in order for him, you know, to beat me. And there are times where people can play a hand perfectly and have, like, you know, they call it an out, right? You know, which is that one card that someone needs, you get it at the end. And sometimes you can pull it out. Sometimes you're drawing blind, drawing dead, where you have the weakest hand, you've already lost. You can't win, but you don't know it yet. And there's still a few cards to go. So the truth is, though, watching the World Series for poker itself is incredibly boring for your typical spectator. It's as much of an endurance sport because the players are sitting on a stool or chair for hours and hours. And they're basically like, it's a really pathetic existence. So you want to say, like, not Osei Byushuvo Shalolam, you just see them, it's really crazy.
And you just got to think, because the people who do this are, many of them are brilliant. I mean, they're math geniuses.
Some are, and some, there was actually a complaint that thanks to movies like Rounders, the whole gambling thing got more popular. Mm-hmm. So you had people who didn't know what they were doing that started signing up because they had disposable income. Sure, I'll give it a whirl.
Dead money.
Right, but they wound up winning because they were bad. Mm-hmm. Like, they played hands they shouldn't have played and just happened to have gotten lucky. Mm-hmm. And people who knew what they were doing often got knocked out earlier because it became so popular it left it open a chance. Anyway, the point of going into this detail is very simple. When you gamble, it could very well be you're taking that explicit chance of, you and I are not so much, it's almost like we're entering into a contract, right? Kind of like, in a weird way, kind of like an asmachta, in terms of, I'm putting in this amount of money under the assumption, well, is it a fair assumption that I'm going to win the hand or that I have the strongest hand? Not at all. People bluff, right? And sometimes you do that. Like, you overplay the hand that you have because the other guy can't keep up. I'm not so sure if the typical rules of asmachta are necessarily going to apply, because let's say even assuming, well, tournaments are different, right, as we said, because tournaments, you're not actually playing with real money. It's more of a sport thing, and you're trying to accumulate points as opposed to cash. Mm-hmm. Let's say you're playing with real cash. You know, it's a little bit hard to say, like, well, I'll, you know, it's not that I'm giving you $5. It's a weird sort of arrangement that everyone kind of mutually agreed to. On the other hand, you can say, well, that's exactly what dice is, right? When you play craps, you know what the rules of craps are before you shoot dice. Or at least you should know the rules of whatever it is that you're trying to gamble. Not that I recommend gambling, but, you know, always know the rules of the game first. Mm-hmm. So based on that, I want to say, well, it doesn't really matter in that regard. That if you're doing a cash game, since certain things are left up to chance, even though you both know the rules, when you put in the money, right, you do so without actually knowing where that money is going. And that alone could be a problem. Even though you both agree to certain terms and certain conditions, willing participants, because of that level of uncertainty, with cards it might be even worse, because with dice you just put in your money and you keep rolling. With cards, at least, there's strategy, right? There's strategy of, well, do I try to bluff the guy out? I don't know if that makes things easier or if that makes things more complicated. Because it means when I put in an additional $50, is it because I think I have the better hand and I'm going to take the pot? No, I'm trying to out-psych you as a person. Much, much, much trickier there. So dice, we can say, is more random. Tournament, we might be able to argue, is more of a point-based system. A cash game of cards, where you have an element of psychology in addition to dice, I don't know. Flip a coin.
What about something?
See what
like
I did there? Yeah.
What about something like betting on a sporting event?
Mm. Yeah, same type of thing. Because there you would say that I would think would be more like shooting dice, mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
Now, look, you've got NCAA tournament pools. Oh, now there, no one has any clue what they're doing, right?
No.
That's a you know, and you so you've got the seeds from Vegas. This could be, you know, really problematic. You know, if the problem is Yeshuvo Shalom and only Yeshuvo Shalom, it wouldn't matter because no one only bets on the NCAA tournament, right? You'd have a bigger problem being a bookie. Mm-hmm. If your problem is with the Kenyan aspect of the Asmachta, whoa, right? Then even a raffle might be a problem because you are taking someone's money unless you assume that the way the transaction is done is, we get your money, that's it, you don't expect anything back, but we're going to do you a favor and, you know, give you something. But that's really not how raffles work.
No.
Right? Maybe the lottery does. The reason being, when you buy tickets, right, say, oh, you've won $1. It's not like we're giving you $1 back. It's you've given up your money, right? Once you part with that dollar to get the ticket, no longer yours. You've effectively given your money away. You don't get that dollar back if you win. Transactionally, it's you just gave away $1. Right? Oh, we're going to give you a refund on that tax that's, you know, they joke that the lottery is a tax for people who are bad at math. So, yeah, we decided to give you a $1 refund this time. You know, don't spend it all in one place. You know, you might be able to say a raffle might be like that too, where the goal is not to get anything back, but the goal is to give someone else, right? As opposed to gambling, the goal is to actually get something. Even people who do a raffle, I don't know anyone who says, like, I mean, by us, I know we keep putting in stuff. Every year there's an annual mikvah raffle in the Lower East Side, and I know every year people have put in money, you know, to try to get us a Megillah. Because the shul doesn't have a Megillah. You know, the main ones had a bin baruch for all. So, yeah. Right? Now, the people who put that down, do they think that we definitely would? Well, no. They might have wanted it bad. I said, wow, wouldn't that be great? But there wasn't that same sense of a transaction of quid pro quo. Yeah. Right? And this is why I'm getting something. At the end of the day, it's pretty complicated. You're going to find people who can spin any, again, no pun there, in any direction that you choose. And it's unfortunate because it's that ambiguous. The Rambam alone, I think it's impossible to make heads or tails of.
Yeah.
Yeah. These, by the way, are unintentional. You should have better standards. But again, the Gemara itself is ambiguous, where there's one source that seems to, the source in Shabbat says that it's Asur, right? Because of Kuvia. And that Kuvia is something that seems to be prohibited. From the Gemara in Sanhedrin, doesn't seem to be that it was universally accepted in the times of the, or at least wasn't as understood to be a prohibition. That's my best guess for why Rambam's all over the place. I have not, to this date, heard a coherent explanation for every single one of these Rambams. I'm sure people have tried, but it's going to be very difficult to do so. So at the end of the day, I don't really have a straight answer. No pun for that one either. See, with these, you could just, like, look for, you know, just, yeah, straight. Never mind. Oy. I don't have a real answer for this in terms of, you know, can I say definitively that it is prohibited? No, I can't. It seems to be that way from the Gemara in Shabbat, not so much from the Gemara in Pesachim. Following Rambam, don't know. In terms of what's the problem with it, also, don't know. We have two opinions in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. One, you might be able to argue with a bit of a stretch that it is stealing, the other one not. There is a nafkamina, there is a practical distinction between them. Rambam seems to inconsistently rely on either one, even though there is that one time when it could go either way. Although, according to, yeah, so I got nothing, basically, on this one. Other than, difficult question, and in terms of how you apply it today, I'm sure you could, you know, find some ways to say, well, this is more analogous than that. And people might even take issue with the distinctions they had on a cash game versus a tournament. And I can't argue with them. Or at least I could argue with them. But like if someone says, well, I disagree, yeah, I get that. Like, I'm not 100% confident in my assessment either, and that might change from time to time. I would just be very wary if anyone tells you definitively, gambling is X or gambling is Y, no, it's not. If you want to be strict on it, fine, I get it. Gambling, you know, can cause a great deal of problems. And you should know from that one tournament, I did see how people can get addicted to it. And especially it's new and it's fun. But you can lose a lot of money really, really fast. I know myself, regardless of the halacha, I know I personally don't have the disposition or the stamina to even try to do a cash game. I am way, way too risk averse. To even be, like, I'm not going to put my, this is a $20 bill, I'm not gambling. I can't do that. I know people who can, but that's not me, right? It's, you know, and there are people who have ruined, who have ruined their lives because of gambling. Like, how does someone get a gambling addiction? You get addicted to that thrill. You get addicted to being in the world, and stuff can happen so, so fast when you, you know, got that, you know, sort of get in that zone. All you need is, like, one hand. As many plots of bad movies have demonstrated. So, anyway, I hope this left you with more questions than answers, because that was the intention of this one. Again, you can interpret things in a lot of different ways. The only thing that I think you cannot do is say with absolute certainty, this is the uniform position on gambling. We saw, I don't know, four or five in Rambam alone, let alone other people. You're going to find people who say it one way, people who say it the other way. I believe the RCA has actually, you know, come out against, you know, casino nights and shuls, you know, I think for being inappropriate for some reason or another. You know, I forget the exact write up there. You know, for that, you might be able to find reason for it, but I don't believe they actually said it was a sewer. I don't believe they used the term forbidden, because even if you don't think it's forbidden, it doesn't seem to be, like, a great thing to do, or at least not on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. You know, I can sort of rationalize it for myself, because I did, you know, one tournament game ever. You know, call it part of entertainment budget, right? You do it for entertainment purposes only, for enjoyment. You've capped your losses. There you go, right? Might say that there's a difference with that, too, in terms of, again, if it's the problem, you should vote shalom. For entertainment, it's not a big deal. But, like, even if you want to say, like, watching TV isn't bad, if all you do is watch TV, you know, that could be problematic, too. Mm-hmm. All right? So, thank you all very much for coming. This Sunday, we're picking up again. I have to remember where we left off from the laws of Shabbat. And next week, we'll do egalitarianism, which would be all sorts of fun. Have a great week.